It's called presidential harassment.
I want nothing.
And it's unfortunate.
I want no quid pro quo.
This should never, ever happen to another president, ever.
I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly. He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney. Yeah, sure.
Shut up,
Rudy.
Moron. Shut up.
Okay, hold on.
Shut up. You don't know what you're talking about.
What they've done to General Flynn.
Russia.
What they've done to others.
It was all bull.
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about all of President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me. Ken is my co-host, a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor. He blogs at popehat.com. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
There have been interesting developments in the Michael Flynn case. The Department of Justice, as we've discussed, has been trying to drop the charges against the former National Security Advisor, even though he already pleaded guilty to making false statements to federal investigators and repeatedly affirmed his guilt to the court. But long-suffering federal judge Emmett Sullivan didn't simply approve the dismissal request. He wants to see arguments about what he should do. And he appointed retired federal judge John Gleason to make an argument that the charges should not be dismissed, since both of the actual parties to this case, the government and Michael Flynn, agree that it should be dismissed. He also asked the retired judge to advise him on whether Flynn should face contempt of court charges for perjuring himself before the court by making what he now says are false statements attesting to his own guilt. So I guess we should first of all note that this is all highly unusual. Have you seen a situation like this?
Nothing remotely like it. Nothing remotely like the government's brief asking for this dismissal on these terms, and certainly nothing like the judge coming back and asking for input like this.
Do they get to do that if two parties in the case are in agreement about how something should be handled? The judge can just appoint somebody else to come in and argue the opposite side?
It really depends on the circumstances. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. If it's a discretionary call by the judge and it's the judge's role to make a decision on something, then possibly yes. But if it's really something that's uniquely in control of the parties, then no. And one of the big disputes that's happening right now and playing out both there in that court and in the appellate court is which one of those this is, whether or not the judge just has to rubber stamp the government's request or whether the judge has discretion to deny it.
So you mentioned the appellate court there. So Judge Sullivan hasn't made a ruling yet on whether to dismiss these charges. He may yet agree to do what the government and Flynn want him to do. But Michael Flynn wants the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to involve itself right away and force Judge Sullivan to dismiss the charges without going through this, what could be an extended process hearing these arguments. And so I guess there's two separate questions here, right? One is, if Judge Sullivan decides not to dismiss these charges eventually, will Flynn be entitled to relief from an appellate court saying, no, Judge Sullivan, you had to dismiss these charges? And then a separate question is he entitled to relief right now? Because there's a higher standard for that, right? For the appellate court to involve itself in the middle of the case before the judge has even made a decision that you would object to. And so I guess, does Flynn, let's start with the right now question. Does Flynn have a good argument right now that the appellate court should involve itself and basically force Emmett Sullivan to not request all this paper and just dismiss the charges?
No, I don't think it's a particularly strong argument for that. Flynn has filed what's called a request for a writ of mandamus, which is a traditional measure of having a court direct someone else to do something. In this case, direct the lower court to make a ruling now instead of later. It's an extraordinary writ. It requires a very high standard of necessity and clarity, and I don't think it's met here. The government's request is, you know, barely 2 weeks old. It's not something that would necessarily be ruled on instantly. And Judge Sullivan hasn't said he's going to deny it. He just said he wants input on the law and issues relating to the motion. That's normally very much within a judge's discretion, and I think it would be extremely unusual for the appellate court to step in and say, no, you can't even take input on this issue.
And then let's talk about the extent to which Judge Sullivan actually has discretion here. I mean, you said, you know, there are some things where the judge is just supposed to rubber stamp what the parties want if the parties are in agreement, and there are other things where he has discretion. Is this a matter where the judge has discretion? I mean, why do they even have to ask the judge for permission to dismiss the charges if the judge simply has to approve that request in all cases?
Josh, there are plausible arguments in both directions. At the heart of this is Rule 48A of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, which says that with the leave of the court, the government can dismiss the indictment. The fundamental argument here is whether or not that clause is meant to protect the defendant or whether it's meant to give the court leave to grant or deny a motion on the court's own discretion. Some people argue, and some cases have suggested, that the clause is only there to prevent the government from harassing defendants by filing a case, dismissing it, and then refiling it. That's its only purpose. Other courts and other examinations of the history of the rule have suggested that it is meant to have the judge have the right to take a look at the basis for dismissal to see whether it's improper. There's a fairly recent note in the Harvard Law Review arguing that the history of the rule shows that that's exactly what it was intended for, to give the judge that power. But there are cases with language that could be used in either direction. So it's not a clear win argument either way, I think.
Why is this unsettled at this point? I mean, when you say that, you know, it's not clear which of these things the rule means, you have to delve into the history to try to figure that out. I guess that would be because this issue doesn't come up very often. You don't have a lot of these situations where the government would like to dismiss a charge and a judge would have some good reason to think about saying, no, you can't. I mean, what we've seen in at least one of the amicus briefs that's been filed here arguing about what the judge should do is basically that, you know, they shouldn't approve the dismissal of the charges because it is being done for an improper political purpose to protect the president. So that certainly seems like a very unusual argument to be able to make about a move to dismiss a criminal case.
Absolutely. And you're right. It's there's so little precedent on it because it's such a bizarre situation. It's rare for the government to move to dismiss a case like this. And it's even rarer for the judge to object. So the circumstances where this would come up and be briefed and be decided by a trial court and appellate court are very rare. Some of the cases that people are relying on in both directions are not exactly on point. They're on other issues of judges trying to interfere with prosecutorial discretion that talk about Rule 48A as an example. So there's a decision by the D.C. Circuit in which a judge goes off on this issue, even though Rule 48 wasn't really part of that case at all. That's one of the ones that Flynn and people supporting Flynn are relying on. So it's really a matter of interpretation and of the legislative history of Rule 48 and what was intended by it. And I think it's an issue that could easily go one way or the other to the Court of Appeals and possibly even to the Supreme Court.
We had talked last week about the possibility that this process could drag on for some time, that it could drag on past the election. I mean, this is a guilty plea that was originally made in 2017, so this has already been going on for a very long time. Are these moves by Flynn's lawyers in theory trying to expedite this process by asking the appellate court weigh in and force the trial court to make this decision now instead of later? Could that end up further prolonging this process? I mean, if this needs to be argued in the appellate court, if it conceivably could end up before the Supreme Court, could that further extend the time that it would take for Michael Flynn to be free of these charges?
It could, but the way things are going right now, I'm not sure it would make a meaningful difference. Judge Sullivan has scheduled oral argument on these issues in July. So you're already talking about pushing this process well into the summer and perilously close to the elections. So again, I think it's unlikely that the Court of Appeal will do anything with this on this writ of mandamus. After that, I think it's even more unlikely that the Supreme Court will get involved in an extraordinary writ. So I don't think that the Court of Appeals process is going to drag this out further. Now, the things that Flynn has done in the past have certainly dragged it out more. And the way Sullivan has reacted to them has dragged it out more. So it really is a perfect storm of the law's delay.
What do you make of this choice of John Gleason to be this court-appointed lawyer, the former federal judge, who will argue against dismissing these charges? He had written a newspaper op-ed pointing out that or arguing that Judge Sullivan had significant discretion over this government motion to dismiss the charges, that he didn't just have to rubber stamp it. And then after that op-ed ran, Sullivan appointed him to this role. That's That's pretty unusual, right? Does Flynn have any reason to be aggrieved about that? I mean, it almost reminds me of Bill Barr writing that unsolicited memo about legal powers of the Attorney General, and then it sort of seeming to lead to him being appointed Attorney General. Does that look like campaigning in public for this role to involve yourself in this case?
Yeah, that's exactly the comparison I was about to make, Josh, to the Barr job application essay. Well, I guess the difference here is that Judge Sullivan is asking him to be, in effect, an advocate for one position. So he's not selecting him to be a neutral in the case. He's selecting him to argue a point that the government is not arguing. Still, I agree that it seems somewhat unseemly to select someone to take on this role who has just written an op-ed on it and sort of staked a claim on a particular position. It seems to suggest that what Sullivan wants is a particular position and not for a different person to come in and choose a position.
And then another argument that Flynn's lawyers have made is that Judge Sullivan is biased against Michael Flynn. They want the case taken away from him, given to some other trial judge to make decisions about matters, including this matter of whether Flynn was in contempt of court, which we'll talk about in a moment. So I'm recalling, I can't remember which case it was about that we previously had this bias argument brought up. And the key thing was that the judge has to be biased against the defendant because of matters that occurred outside the court. That if the defendant's antics or other behavior in the process of being tried for something caused the judge to have certain feelings about the defendant, that doesn't count as improper bias.
That's right, Josh. Usually you cannot disqualify a judge for ruling against you. Otherwise, everyone would try to disqualify the judge every time they lost. There has to be an extrinsic basis of bias, like the judge knows you outside work, or you have some sort of beef with the judge's spouse or something like that. That said, a court of appeals will, on occasion, when it reverses a case, send it back to a different judge if they think that the judge has been off base sufficiently in a case. It's pretty rare, and one always gets clients asking you to do it on appeal, and you usually have to talk them out of it because it's an argument the appellate court 99 times out of 100 doesn't like. I don't think that anything Sullivan has done here falls into that category. He has very strong views on the evidence and the law in the case, but the judges are allowed to have that.
So first of all, I believe it was Judge Amy Berman Jackson. Roger Stone had argued that she was biased against him and tried to get her removed from her own case unsuccessfully. This whole Flynn saga that has gone on for so long, one aspect of it that's funny to me is there was a phase during this process where the Flynnistas thought that Judge Emmett Sullivan was going to be their savior. Judge Emmett Sullivan had, about a decade ago, lit into federal prosecutors who committed certain kinds of misconduct in the process of prosecuting former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. He therefore had this reputation as being this sort of pro-defendant judge, they thought that the government had engaged in all sorts of misconduct with regard to their client. And there was this period where it was going to be basically that, Judge Sullivan is going to slap down the government and he's going to be our savior because he's so fair. And then when he didn't do that, the opinion about him changed on a dime. So they previously had a view about Judge Sullivan where they actually thought that he was relatively favorable to their interests.
Yeah, and the Flynnistas had sort of a QAnon type view of Judge Sullivan. So for instance, when the case was transferred to Judge Sullivan, there was a standard order issued that gets ordered in every single case in front of him that mentions a requirement to turn over Brady information, that is exculpatory evidence. And all the Flynn people thought that this was a clear signal that Judge Sullivan had independently determined there had been Brady violations and that the government was hiding evidence, and this was a secret signal that he was going to throw out the case because he was mad about that. So a lot of magical thinking like that from the start. And that's it's a mixture of the craziness that has surrounded all of these cases and the bad reporting on them, and I guess just sort of the measure of social media society.
So finally, let's talk about this contempt issue, that that Judge Sullivan wants guidance not just on whether he should approve this motion to dismiss the case. He wants guidance on, you know, should Michael Flynn face contempt charges for perjuring himself, for saying repeatedly to the court that he was guilty of this offense that he now says he's not guilty of. And so I guess, you know, that seems like something that must come up fairly frequently, right? I mean, it's obviously not standard to change your plea, but defendants do change their pleas from guilty to not guilty, right? And, you know, is that automatically, have you perjured yourself? Would it be normal for the court to try to punish someone for doing that?
No, it's very abnormal, and it happens extremely rarely. So every time you make a guilty plea in federal court, you have to be under oath when you answer all the questions. And so in theory, you could be punished for having told a lie about something in that plea colloquy. It's intended to make people take seriously and then not come back later and change their story, much like Flynn has. So for instance, you know, you have to say that you discussed all the facts with your attorney and all the law with your attorney and you understand your rights. That's designed to keep you from coming back later saying my conviction should be overturned because I didn't talk to it. I didn't talk about this with my attorney and I didn't know my rights. There's a couple of problems with the idea of pursuing Flynn for perjury here, I think. One problem is that the government's motion doesn't exactly say it should be dismissed because he's not guilty. It more says that the case shouldn't be pursued because it's not just to pursue it. And that there are doubts about things like materiality of Flynn's lies. Second of all, to prove perjury, you have to prove that someone knowingly lied. And the thrust of the government's motion is that Flynn couldn't have known that these lies were not material to the government's investigation. So under the government's theory, he wouldn't have known that his lies were not material and he couldn't have lied in pleading guilty. And finally, it's a fairly grotesque imbalance of power situation. People plead guilty because really they don't have another good alternative. And for the government to use its power to get someone to plead guilty and then for someone to say, well, if even the government wants you to withdraw your plea and dismiss the case, I'm going to prosecute you for perjury for pleading guilty when the government used its power to get you to do so, that's a fairly ugly thing. It's a huge imbalance of power, and I think it's quite unjust.
Do you think that Sullivan's behavior here has been proper? And I ask that because, I mean, looking at this, I think we all see what has happened here, and we see the politicization of the Justice Department and Attorney General Bill Barr acting in a special manner to protect an associate of the president in a way that a normal criminal defendant would not get any sort of protection. And it makes me worried about the rule of law. It is a good reason not to vote to reelect Donald Trump. Is any of this Judge Sullivan's business? I mean, just because there is an injustice somewhere in the country doesn't mean that any particular judge in his own court is in a position where he is supposed to act on that basis. I guess I'm asking basically, is this a political question about the misuse of the executive branch that has to be fixed by changing who's running the executive branch? Is it appropriate for Sullivan to be standing in the way of the government at a time when it tries to exercise prosecutorial discretion, even prosecutorial discretion that we don't think makes a lot of sense or is just to drop a charge?
I think there's a decent argument that it's not appropriate for him to do so, that it would be ludicrous for him, in effect, to sentence Flynn with the government arguing that he shouldn't even be prosecuted, that it is a betrayal of the basic separation of powers principles. And you can believe that without believing that the government is acting in good faith. I mean, I think the government on this is completely corrupt, but still I have doubts about whether it's appropriate for Sullivan to be taking this stance. But Josh, I think you have to point out that this is sometimes the way federal judges act, and it may not necessarily be about Trump or about politics or about this issue. You know, like the old joke goes, the difference between federal judge and God is that God doesn't think he's a federal judge. And federal judges will go on a wild tear like this sometimes on a wide variety of topics. And the fact that this time it has to be happening in the public limelight and on a highly publicized case, I think may get people to think that this is an extreme extreme outlier in how judges act. It may be an outlier in terms of application to this particular procedural posture, to this idea of a judge, you know, appointing someone independent to look at this. But judges decide that they get to push the parties around and do things that they actually don't get to do all the time. It's kind of a thing, lawyers will tell you. So I'm not sure if what's going on here isn't some sort of deep political bias by Sullivan or some sort of, you know, wild hair up his ass about Donald Trump as much as it is. He sees it as basically an affront to his primacy in the courtroom as a judge. And so he's acting like a federal judge.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the president and inspectors general. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. So at the same time this has been going on with Michael Flynn and the apparent end of Justice Department proceedings that might hold accountable people who are associated with the president has also been trying to rid himself of troublesome inspectors general. Inspectors general are officials within executive branch departments who are supposed to investigate misconduct within those departments. They're quasi-independent. They're appointed by the president, but they often carry over between presidential administrations. And if the president fires them, he's supposed to explain to Congress why he did so. With regard to State Department Inspector General Steve Linnick, the president simply told Congress he no longer has confidence in him. After the firing, we learned that Linnick had been conducting investigations related to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's own conduct. So first of all, I guess you know Steve Linnick?
Yeah, I served with him in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles in the 1990s. And, you know, he was a straight shooter, very smart, honest, well-respected, someone that I think you would want to see in an inspector general type role.
Is there any legal bar to what the president is doing here? I mean, I said that inspectors general are quasi-independent. They are executive branch officials. And there are norms around, you know, reasons that you're not supposed to fire them. And there may be some political blowback to the president for doing this. Is he completely within his legal rights here, though?
Yes, he is. It's fundamentally an executive position, and he can hire and fire them. In fact, there was some controversy about this and about the Inspector General statute when it was passed. You know, this was in the wake of Watergate. It was in the Carter administration. And some of the early drafts of the statute, the Justice Department, even under Carter, thought might be unconstitutional because they limited the president's power to fire the Inspector General. It made the Inspector General beholden to Congress rather than the president. And they thought that was a constitutional violation. So the statute was changed a bit such that the inspector general reports to the department heads and the president retains the power to fire the inspector general. So it's pretty clear that that's constitutionally required. So it is a norm and it is political blowback that are the restraints keeping someone from just willingly firing inspector generals because they don't like what they're doing. Clearly, those norms and political blowback are not operating at this point.
If that norm has been destroyed, and I mean, you know, for example, suppose that Joe Biden wins this election. I assume that, you know, whatever people have gotten appointed into these inspector general positions that are people that Trump is presumably choosing because he thinks they'll be more politically loyal, I imagine that Biden would want to be rid of them and would have a pretty good argument about why he should be rid of those particular inspectors general. But that would also be something of a violation of what had been the norm. So is there any way to build a legal framework here? You talk about the constitutional concerns. The president can't fire members of the Federal Reserve Board. So, I mean, it seems like there are structures that you could have that would make these positions more actually independent rather than just independent by norm.
Sure. But the question is where you would have to put the inspector generals. You might have to make them an arm of Congress rather than an executive branch arm or somehow otherwise get around the separation of powers issues. And, you know, we've gotten past these issues before. This was the issue with the independent counsel statute that the Supreme Court upheld over very strong conservative dissent. So there may be ways to fix it, but for now, I think we're dealing just with norms. And I think you're completely right that if Biden wins, Biden's going to want to fire the Trump loyalists who are put into these positions. And that's just going to further erode the norms.
U.S. Attorney for Connecticut John Durham has been for some time assigned to investigate the investigators. He's been looking into the origins of the investigation into the 2016 Trump campaign's possible links to Russia. And Attorney General Bill Barr made some remarks about that investigation this week. He said criminal investigations should not be used as a political weapon. He meant that as a reference to the investigation of figures around Trump, though, of course, one could apply that statement to the Durham investigation itself. Barr did say that he doesn't expect the Durham investigation to lead to a criminal investigation of either Barack Obama or Joe Biden personally, that they're looking elsewhere at other figures. Barr also referenced the recent Supreme Court decision about Bridgegate. He noted that, you know, as the Supreme Court said unanimously in that Bridgegate case, an egregious abuse of power is not necessarily a crime. So was that bit about Bridgegate, was that Barr tipping his hand that Obamagate, whatever you call that, whatever that is, that it's not a criminal matter, that they're not going to be bringing charges over this? What they're alleging here is that the Obama administration abused its political power.
I don't know if you can necessarily take it that way when you take all of his comments in balance, because he also says that, you know, if there were criminal violations, then they should be pursued. And the nature of the investigation and the length of the investigation certainly indicates that it's thorough enough that it could lead to some sort of criminal charges or grand jury investigation. Josh, the other thing that has just broken in the news this week that's of interest is that it's been revealed that Barr met with Durham immediately after Robert Mueller's report was released. The timeline apparently is that Mueller gave his draft report to Barr, and you recall that Barr released a statement characterizing it that many thought was misleading and minimized what Mueller's report said. And apparently Barr met with Durham several times immediately after that, within days of that sequence of events. And people are wondering if basically this plan to have Durham be doing this investigation and change the narrative about the last 3 years was in the works from the very start, from the moment that report hit.
In terms of changing the narrative, there's a weird way here in which it feels to me like the clock is running down. I mean, the criminal investigations take a long time. They have not, so far as we can tell, tried to bring any sort of criminal charges here. Now, obviously, the president could be reelected, and that would give him 4 more years to pursue this. But it seems more likely to me that what they would hope to achieve, at least in the next few months, would be, as you're describing, some changes in the narrative rather than, you know, substantive, you know, criminal prosecutions. And at the same time that you have John Durham working on that within the Justice Department, you have the Senate, controlled by Republicans. The president has been pushing for the Senate to conduct investigations related to this, which would, again, you know, try to draw more news toward that away from the coronavirus. And so Lindsey Graham, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, has released a long list of witnesses that he might seek to call to talk about these matters that the president is so aggrieved over. It includes Andrew McCabe, James Comey, also sitting FBI Director Christopher Wray. And so I'm wondering, first of all, some of those people may not wish to testify before Congress. Would they have significant ability to resist subpoenas if they received them about this long enough to delay that through the election?
They could use some of the same tactics that we've seen Trump loyalists use over the last few years. In fact, they could pretty much carbon copy some of the arguments that the Trump administration has used to resist some of the subpoenas. For instance, the argument that there's no legitimate legislative purpose to the inquiry or anything like that. And certainly if they refused the subpoena and forced the Senate to try to compel them, or if they filed suit trying to quash the subpoenas, those legal proceedings could drag out, just as all the attempts during the Mueller investigation and during the congressional investigations and during the impeachment dragged out.
Last week, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals allowed one of the emoluments cases against President Trump to continue. This is the suit brought by the governments of Maryland and the District of Columbia, saying the president's acceptance of foreign emoluments in the form of paid stays at his hotel near the White House are interfering with business at their own state-owned conference facilities. A 3-judge panel of the Fourth Circuit had thrown out this case, but then the full panel of all 15 judges on the Fourth Circuit reheard it en banc, and they voted 9-6 along party lines based on whether they'd been appointed by Democratic or Republican presidents to allow discovery in the case to continue as Maryland and D.C. try to obtain financial records related to the hotel. So what's the substance of the dispute about whether this case should have been dismissed or not?
Well, it's interesting, Josh, because this is a very weird procedural posture, and it's a little bit like that Flynn writ of mandamus that we talked about earlier. What happened is this. The trial court declined to dismiss the entire emoluments case by D.C. in Maryland. And Trump asked that court to certify it for immediate appeal. Normally, when a court declines to dismiss a case, you don't get to appeal immediately. You have to wait till the case is over and there's a final judgment. But you can ask a federal court, if there's a novel issue of law that might resolve the case, to certify it, to say, okay, now's time for the appeal. You can do a special appeal of this issue. That's very much in the trial court's discretion, whether to do it or not. And when the court refused to do that, Trump sought a writ of mandamus from the appellate court. That's, again, a very aggressive move. It's an extraordinary writ. It's very disfavored. And that's what the dispute is, not just about the substance, that is, whether or not an emoluments case like this can survive, but whether or not the Court of Appeals should intervene at this stage of the case, which is extraordinary. And what the majority here said is no, that the president had not shown the extraordinary nature of relief necessary. So not necessarily endorsing that the case will ultimately survive when it gets to them on regular appeal, just that it's not clear enough to intervene at this stage. And what resulted was a unusually bitter and divided group of judges taking shots at each other, with the judges in dissent really going off into some rather purple prose about how political the majority was being themselves rather, to my mind, transparently political, and the majority taking shots right back at them. It was like a high school gym fight with factions yelling and shouting and throwing punches.
Ken, we should expect this case to proceed to discovery in that case, and the president will have to hand over financial records related to his hotel?
Well, depending. It's possible they'll seek relief from the Supreme Court. The procedural posture is not favorable for that because, again, they're seeking an extraordinary writ. It's not the type of thing the court normally takes. Otherwise, yes, I think you can expect the plaintiffs below to press for discovery and for Trump to do everything he can to delay and distract and see what he can do to push it out past the election.
There is so much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place for us to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh. Stay safe.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail at 424-538-8888. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers. We'll be right back.